Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Thanks for tuning in again to our online talk show. This has been a busy week for sure, both politically and personally. On the international and national scene, we've had pirates and puppies. And on my scene, I've been getting ready for my Myth America book tour. And right now, as you're listening to this, I'm at my first stop in New Mexico. I'm headed to Eureka Springs, Arkansas, and Kansas City on this trip. You can go to cindysheehansoapbox.blogspot.com for more info on my tour. So far, we have about 30 cities lined up, so I have to be coming to a town near you. Today, as always, we have a fascinating show. I'll be speaking to Dr. Justin Frank. He's a psychiatrist who wrote a very fascinating and compelling book called Bush on the Couch. He analyzes George Bush using a very innovative technique. We'll be right back with Dr. Frank after the break. This is Cindy Sheehan. You're listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
My name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you're listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.cindysheehansoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.cindysheehansoapbox.com.
Join the tent city next to the National Big Business Gathering at Ford Field on June 15th through 17th, 2009. The National Business Summit, sponsored by the Detroit Economic Club at Ford Field. Millionaire capitalists like the heads of ConocoPhillips, Dow Chemical, General Motors, Chrysler, Humana Incorporated, Ascension Health, BNSF Railway Company, and PVS Chemicals, as well as the presidents of the National Council on Competitiveness and U.S. Chamber of Commerce, will gather at this summit. As well as the presidents of the National Council on Competitiveness and U.S. Chamber of Commerce will gather at this summit. President Barack Obama and cabinet members have been invited. These wealthy businessmen, yes, almost all of them are rich white men, will put their greedy heads together to discuss innovation and policy ideas in technology, energy, environment, and manufacturing. In other words, they will be strategizing on how to further increase their profits at the expense of the ever-shrinking middle class, the vast working class, and the growing millions living in utter poverty. The National Business Summit will be held in a city with record-high unemployment and poverty rates, layoffs, budget cuts, school closings, utility cost hikes and shutoffs, and massive home foreclosures. With a registration fee of $1,495, it is unlikely that any victims of foreclosures and evictions, let alone laid-off workers, will be able to attend the National Business Summit. No one at this event will be speaking in the interests of those most affected by the economic collapse. The People's Summit will be a dynamic event. During the People's Summit, organizers will implement a moratorium on foreclosure evictions by going into the neighborhoods and supporting homeowners who are willing to confront the bailiffs. If there is a strike, demonstration, or sit-in, the People's Summit will join it. The People's Summit will confront the big business CEOs and politicians gathering next door. Join us. That's People's Summit, June 14th through 17th, 2009. Grand Circus Park, Detroit, Michigan. 4 days of active resistance, political discussion, and strategizing for a people's stimulus plan and an economic bill of rights for working people and the poor at Ford Field on June 15th through 17th, 2009.
His name is Dr. Justin Frank, but I call him Justy. Justy, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Cindy.
Oh, it's so nice to talk to you.
Yeah.
So with full disclosure and complete transparency being the trademark, hallmark, and goal of Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, before we go on, I'm going to have you tell my listeners what kind of dogs you have.
Ah, well, I have two Portuguese water dogs.
Oh, that sounds familiar.
And that is familiar, and they are not at all from the same litter or even the same breeder as President Obama's new dog. But one of them sort of looks like Bo a little bit. But you've met my dog.
I've met,
I've had them for a long time, and I don't think he's copying me because he doesn't even know me or my dogs.
But I just wanted to get that out of the way because it seems
important.
Like it's very important what kind of dogs people have these days.
And
apparently because it's all over the news and that's about the only thing that you can see on the news. But I actually have met also Senator Kennedy's Portuguese water dogs.
Oh, you have? Splash.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. They're awesome. They're good. Bo is very cute. He deserves all the attention that he can get. But, you know, for reals, we have some serious problems going on in the world, and I would like to see the media kind of pay attention to some of those problems, too.
Well, that would be very nice if that happened. I'm not counting on it, but the more we talk, the more exposure there is to these problems.
So let's just get right down to our interview. You wrote an amazing book called Bush on the Couch. I read that before I had an opportunity to meet you.
Right.
And before you describe your research and your conclusions, I think it's important for my listeners, I know my listeners know this, but it's important for people to understand that analyzing George Bush, his personal life, his public life, his administration, it's not old news or a waste of time or divisive or irrelevant.
Yeah.
I believe, and I know you do too, that we can't move forward with hope or in hope, unless we learn from our past. And if we don't, as they say, we're doomed to repeat it. So I believe this topic is super relevant today. I'm glad you're on so we can keep this dialogue and discussion going. So now tell my listeners about the book and your research and your conclusion.
Well, I wrote this book in 2003. In 2000 and early 2004, and it was published before the 2004 election. And I did a lot of research. I'm a psychoanalyst by trade and practice and a teacher, but the psychoanalysis is a form of exploration of the personality and of the unconscious, and it's a particular technique that was devised by Freud many years ago. And in the original days, Freud did something called applied psychoanalysis, which is taking psychoanalytic principles like questions of patterns and motives and behavior and applied them to people who could never get in the consulting room. That's why it was called applied psychoanalysis. And the CIA started doing that. And in fact, Roosevelt, way before we had a CIA, asked for a psychoanalytic evaluation of Hitler. So there could be a way, he felt, of negotiating with him after World War II ended. So I'm in a long tradition of applying psychoanalysis to public figures, although nobody has ever done it with a president, and we've usually only done it with foreign leaders. But I felt compelled to do it with Bush because I was really concerned that he showed a lot of characteristics that disturbed me, most specifically a kind of massive ability to evade responsibility, which I noticed in before the 2000 election when he was interviewed by Jay Leno or somebody like that and was asked if he could remember anything that he did that was bad or that he's ashamed of.
Right.
And he couldn't think of anything at all.
That's pretty amazing to, you know, get to be that age and not do anything that
right,
you're ashamed of or whatever. And some of the criticism of your book has been that you didn't interview him or you didn't, you know, sit down personally with him. But this applied psycho analytic tool. Like you said, there's a long tradition of it. It's very well respected. And it seems to me that it would be a little easier to do it these days than to do it during Freud's days, because I know you watched George Bush assiduously. You
Yes.
studied his body language. You studied his words. You studied what was written about him and what he said. So there was a lot of material that you used to in your research for this book, wasn't there?
Yes, there's a lot of material. And in fact, one of the things, in many ways, I have more material than Freud would have ever had, but than even I have about my own patients who I see in my office, because part of psychoanalysis is a long, slow development of a relationship with another person, and I only think about other people in their lives based on what they tell me.
Right.
But in this case, and based on my own experience subjectively sitting with them, but this is really a very different experience, and I got to watch over and over again, in fact, all of the videos, all of the press conferences, and read every day WhiteHouse.gov and all the different speeches that he gave, and learned a lot about him with his body language, his slips of the tongue, his way of treating the press at press conferences,
right.
His attitude, the smirk that you could see on television, which, of course, in your analytic room you might not see, and then the people he surrounded himself with, and people who like to live outside the law, and were very secretive and hiding, specifically Cheney, of course. And so I really felt very much that I got to know him quite well over the period of a year and a half. He's not terribly different from, a percentage of people in this country. The thing is that he shouldn't have been president. There's a lot of people. There are some people like him, people who have streaks of cruelty, who use humor as a way of putting other people down, who jump to conclusions, who use religion as a way of avoiding responsibility, who like to simplify how they think and treat everything in terms of right and wrong, good and evil, cowboys and Indians kind of thing. And he also used fear to stay in power. He
right.
liked to make other people afraid, and what I realized after really studying him was that he is the person who is afraid, and he was afraid. He was afraid to meet you
right.
when you were camped outside.
I don't blame him.
I don't blame him
a second about that. That was a real fear.
Well, it was a real fear, but he's afraid to get into a discussion with people and to think in public. And I remember in 2003, he was afraid to speak in front of the British Parliament, even at the time when they were theoretically supporting him in the early days.
Well, I'd like to talk about, how you diagnosed him and what your diagnosis was. But first of all, your last answer, brought up two questions for me. You said that his verbal slips told you
yes.
a lot about him, and some people would call those Freudian slips, right? That
right.
that there's something is going on behind that. Do you remember one that you can give us as an example?
Well, the most famous one that is the best example, I think, that exists is when he said that. He said in 2004, terrorists never stop thinking of ways to hurt the American people, and neither do we.
Oh, yes. And what did that...
Well, now, he meant to say, we don't stop thinking about terrorists to protect the
right,
American
right.
people. But unconsciously, he was revealing some confusion about who's the terrorist, whether it's him or whether it's Al-Qaeda. And he's also unconsciously talking about the fact that there is a part of him that does want to hurt the American people.
And why do you think he does? Do you think it's intentional? Do you think that he just was going along with the flow? I know in your book you wrote a lot about his cruelty when he
yep.
was growing up.
He was very cruel. He was cruel to... he used to stick firecrackers into frogs and light them and blow them up. In the second edition of my book, I actually heard a speech given by Neil Bush at a third grade school when he was talking about how his big brother George used to line up the kids in the hallway and make them run down the hall naked while he'd shoot at them with a BB gun.
Yeah, that sounds like pre-serial killer behavior.
It's very pre-serial killer. But the thing, and he used to light fires until he was maybe 12 or 13. But I think the main thing about the cruelty in terms of why he might be cruel is I think that he very much envied people who were strong and brave. I think he was very intimidated by his father. He was a person who was too afraid to join the military himself and got out of it. And I think that he has an unconscious... I don't think this is conscious. I think what's important is slips reveal, as Freudian slips, they reveal unconscious fantasies. They're not necessarily what he says. They reveal fantasies about what a person is thinking, and the mistakes they make almost reveal certain aspects of their personality that they're not aware of. So I don't think he's aware consciously of wanting to hurt the troops, but I think unconsciously it's very clear how he wanted to hurt the troops and send them off. There have been a lot of examples of his supporting not giving equipment, not giving proper protection,
right.
All kinds of things, not planning at all. There's a long history of his comfort with being hurtful, and he was very nasty to some of the press who would ask him direct questions. He was very interested in taking revenge and was very violent. I think that his father was a war hero and was very famous when he was little. And growing up, his father was a very hard person to live up to. And George was never as tall as his brother, never a big guy, and learned to become powerful in his own way by being a cheerleader, by being cruel to people and being a bully verbally, by getting alcohol all the time and making fake IDs. Lots of kids do this. I mean,
right.
Some kids do this.
Right.
But he just kept doing it and doing it and doing it and lying and lying and lying and getting away with it. And basically, the more you do that, the more you become afraid that somebody's going to come and get you. So you end up you end up seeing all the weak parts of yourself and attributing them to other people. So he really hates poor people. He hates weak people. You could see that in his mother's comment about the Katrina victims,
right.
Which is so famous. And he was full of contempt. I still remember the thing when he was going to be asked to talk with you, and he said, well, he has to go back to riding his bicycle, or he was worried about his knee. I mean, it was unbelievable.
Yeah, he said that.
I have to get on with my life.
He has to get on with his life.
I know. It was unbelievable. So he's always been this way. And I think that one of the things that we can learn, there's a few things that are really important about the book that apply to the here and now, I think.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that's very important, I wrote in the second edition of the book, which came out a few years ago, which is one of the dangers we can have if we don't pay attention, is that we might end up looking for someone. I actually wrote this out. I'm just reading the very end of it. It says, how could our national trauma today might be embodied in a single question, quote, how could our national father do this to us? That's the ultimate question. How could he do this to us?
Right.
What he's done economically. And then I wrote that perhaps asking that question and searching for a way to resolve the attendant crisis will lead us to search for someone completely different from Bush in 2008, someone who's not male or who's not white,
mm-hmm.
which, of course, were the two leaders, it
right.
turned out. At that
right.
time, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we want, you know, a mother figure or a completely fresh father figure, but if we just choose someone based on overt differences, different kinds of parents, to brush the Bush disaster under the rug, we will be no better than changing a Band-Aid on a fracture.
And I'm afraid that's what we've done. And
that's what I worry about.
Yeah, and with people who saying that, and even the new president saying we have to move forward.
Yes.
You know, let's move forward and get things right. I don't think we can move forward and get things right unless we acknowledge what went wrong.
Right. I think we have to do both.
But right, exactly.
He really feels that they are mutually exclusive somehow.
Yeah,
and he did just about right before you called, about a half an hour before, I know this interview is being aired on Sunday, but this is Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
And on Thursday, it just was announced that he has released the memos from, the legal memos from 2005. Allowing the torture, you know, legitimizing the torture.
Mm-hmm.
But he also said that he was not going to prosecute any of the members of the CIA who were involved in this. So on the one hand, he's believing in total transparency, and on the other hand, it's not so clear. And I think that he is very reluctant to look backward. And I think that Bush and Obama is confusing this way, because Bush is clear about it. He said somebody asked him what he thought about himself, and he said, the only time I ever look in the mirror is when I comb my hair in the morning. I mean, that's what Bush said.
Mm-hmm.
Obama does think a lot more than Bush. He is different from Bush.
Well, yeah, that's not
but,
that's not like saying a whole
not,
lot.
Right, but he's not. But I worry about the same old thing, and we're going to be in Afghanistan forever, and
right.
Iraq, and I mean, just I worry about the same things that are going on now that were going on with Bush.
We have to take a break right now. We'll be right back. We're talking to Justin Frank. This is Cindy Sheehan, Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Please stay tuned.
A Nation Rocked to Sleep, written and read by Carly Sheehan. Have you ever heard the sound of a mother screaming for her son? The torrential rains of a mother's weeping will never be done. They say he's a hero. You should be glad that he's won. But have you ever heard the sound of a mother screaming for her son? Have you ever heard the sound of a father holding back his cries? He must be brave because his son died for another man's lies. The only grief he allows himself are long, deep sighs. Have you ever heard the sound of a father holding back his cries? Have you ever heard the sound of taps played at your brother's grave? They say he died so the flag will continue to wave. But I believe he died because they had oil to save. Have you ever heard the sound of taps played at your brother's grave? Have you ever heard the sound of a nation being rocked to sleep? The leaders want to keep you numb so the pain won't be so deep. But if we, the people, let them continue, another mother will weep. Have you ever heard the sound of a nation being rocked to sleep?
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you're listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.cindysheehansoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.cindysheehansoapbox.com.
Thank you for staying tuned. We're talking to my dear friend, Justy Frank. We're talking about George Bush, his problems that became national problems. It was one thing, like you said, many people have acted like George Bush. Usually our children grow out of it, but usually They don't grow up to be president of the United States. So it's unfortunate that that happened in our country. I thought of a couple of questions in the first break, and I do want to talk about Obama and his 100 days, about, you know, what you think he's accomplished, what you think he needs to accomplish so we can heal, move forward as a nation with accountability. However, you immersed yourself in George Bush. You immersed yourself in that family that is a pretty scary family. We talked about his dad. His mom seems to be even a more dominant factor in his life. I don't think he was raised with a lot of love or affection, but did studying such a tainted person taint you also? Did you have to like constantly fight against cynicism or just real a darkness when you were doing this?
No, I really felt that when I was studying him, I'm not sure what would make me cynical, except that it made me disappointed that so many people could fall for him.
Mm-hmm.
And even though many people contend that he wasn't elected either time, and in some ways that's probably true, legitimately, he sure got a lot of votes.
Well, right. A cynical statement would be, what was that newspaper in Great Britain after the 2004 election that said, how could 58,000 people be so 58 million people be so stupid?
Yes, I remember that headline. And then so I got very discouraged. I was discouraged about how so many people could be so stupid. That's true. What I've learned in writing this book, and I think you've pointed this out in some ways just already in this interview, in one way or another, people are actually uncomfortable with the idea that they have an unconscious. And people are uncomfortable with psychological terms. Everybody puts it down as psychobabble, that what proof do I have? Well, the proof is that everything I wrote about in 2004, George Bush continued to do for 4 years, and only more so.
Right.
And that he really was devoted to bringing down this country, including economically. But I think that it's an unconscious cruelty. It's a hatred of all kinds of things that have to do with his own parents. But I think that people are stupid because they don't want to think. It's sort of the question I asked that I just mentioned to you. How could our father do this to us? How could our national father, who's supposed to protect us, do this to us? Why would he do this to us? And
so
people,
do people think then he's not doing it to us? He must have be good. His intentions must be good, because you know, this is something that the ruling class, or the robber class, I call them, they like to do. They like to attach themselves with God.
Yes.
As much as possible. So people think, well, you know, this is a godly man. And so I still get emails from people. He's a faithful person. He believes in God. He listens to God. He's a Christian. His morals are good. So therefore, what he's done in killing over a million people and destroying the economy of this country, it must have been for a good reason.
Right. I think that he did ally himself with God in a very clever way, and he allied himself with God in a way that is really disturbing to me, which is that I think that he took advantage of a lot of people who do have faith,
right,
and who are believers, and he made them think that he's a believer and that he has faith, when in fact he actually seduced so many people and tricked them, because he used faith or he used his connection, shall we say, to God as a way of keeping himself almost indistinguishable from God or from a fantasy of God, just
right,
like he did from the United States. He mixed all three things of America, himself, and God all into one thing. And I think that he took advantage of people's faith, and that people trusted him beyond the capacity to think. They just really had blind faith.
And they still trust him.
And there are many people who still trust him. I mean,
I get the emails, too, that I
get emails about that. Yeah. But I have, you know, Tim Robbins had a great line in a play he did on Broadway called Embedded that was there in about the Iraq, the reporters.
Mm-hmm.
2005, one of the reporters was saying, I know he's a liar, but I trust him.
Wow.
I mean, that just summed it up.
Wow. That really does say it all. When you say it's unconscious, his problems or whatever, do you think when he said that my son and the other Americans died for a noble cause that he really believes that?
No.
No?
I don't think so.
What do you think he...
I think he really is saying that in order to justify what he's done. I think there's a part of him that has to always justify. People who are alcoholics, who are psychopathic, find ways to justify what they've done so they don't ever have to take full responsibility or acknowledge what they've done. They never acknowledge making a mistake. They never acknowledge that the war was a mistake. They won't acknowledge anything. So they really talk about a noble cause as a way of evading both responsibility in terms of attacks from other people or criticism from people like us, let's say, but also as a way of evading having to actually look in the mirror and actually having to think about who he was. I had a patient once who never made a mistake. And he blamed his wife for everything. He blamed his kids. He blamed his parents. He blamed his boss. And finally, I said to him, have you ever made a mistake in your life? And he looked at me and he said, yes, hiring you. I think that's how George Bush thinks. He's never done anything wrong. He completely justifies anything he does. And the way alcoholics do it is they do what's called confabulate. They make up explanations to justify what they're doing. So his explanations for the war were constantly changing.
Right.
And, you know, lots of people have written about this and talked about it, but they don't understand the psychology of doing that. It's a way of making things up on the spur of the moment because he's too uncomfortable about looking at himself or actually taking time to think. What's so refreshing about the current president, even though I have lots of questions about him, is that he does seem to take time to think and talk with people and try to help all of us think. But one of the things that I realized with large-scale political life in America was that the other thing that's important to remember is to think psychologically for all of us as voters and as citizens to try to look beyond the words and look at the words in different ways. For instance, when somebody says what they're not, it's very often what they are.
Right.
The best example is George Bush saying, I'm a uniter, not a divider. Well, if there was anybody who was more divisive in this country,
absolutely,
I can't imagine who that
right.
was
well, yeah.
be in history.
Yeah.
And so what that prompted me and got me thinking and, you know, percolating is when Obama talks about change, I'm wondering if he unconsciously may also mean keeping things the same, that, you know, that there may be something. He doesn't say, I'm not for the status quo. At least he doesn't say that.
Right.
He believes in change. But
right.
I think that there's something about the fact that he really, that change does not mean, he confuses his statement. I don't know if you read his statement today, that he said this is a time for reflection, not retribution. When he released the memos,
right.
released
so,
the legal thing.
Yeah, that seems now, a lot like maintaining the status quo to me.
Well, but it's a confusion
right.
in that the choice is only reflection or retribution.
Right.
The reason for punishing people who do things is not necessarily retribution. It's not to punish them because we're having retribution. Punishing them is not going to bring Casey back to life. It's not going to help anybody who's been maimed and
right.
hurt. It's just not going to. But it is going to help us really begin to look at the moral problems in this country and at what people did and have it completely exposed and out there for everybody to see. I mean, I would like nothing better than to have George Bush rot in jail for the rest of his life. That's true. But the purpose of it is not retribution. And I think that Obama has created a false split between reflection and retribution, which is actually not true. There's a lot of ways to investigate and to make everything very clear without talking about, you know, a lynch mob mentality.
Well, and it's also about healing, and we haven't done that in our in the nation since the beginning. We've never a reflection would be wonderful, but that reflection should lead to healing and a change of policy, a change of you know, national policy. I would like our leaders to actually give us, even though, you know, 58 million people voted for George Bush, I would like them to give us some kind of credit for being intelligent. It seemed like the Bush regime was so arrogant that they thought that every time they changed the reason for the occupation or invasion of Iraq, that we were supposed to forget the old reason and just
go on.
And say, oh, okay, well, okay, it's for imposing democracy. Oh, okay, it was for regime change. And just like in 1984, when we were supposed to forget that we were just at, or they were just at war with Eurasia, now they're at war with East Asia. You know, so we also have to let our leaders know that we're not stupid and that we remember what they say, and we're going to hold them accountable for what they say.
The key thing that you said to me, at least from a psychoanalytic point of view, is the importance of memory and the importance of not forgetting. Because forgetting is almost always, in this case, in the service of denial of responsibility.
Yes.
So in the sense of the, for the 58 million people who keep forgetting and going along with Bush, part of their forgetting is a way of avoiding and evading looking at him for his own destructiveness. And so people just don't remember, and they go out of their way not to remember, and they dumb themselves down. There's a lot of people, as you said, who don't forget and who haven't forgotten. I mean, I think that one of the best examples has always been Jon Stewart, who uses these old videos to just prove that, you know, there's, let's not forget this stuff. And of course, it's easier to break through that denial in on television now. But Obama is very much for reflecting without taking action. And I think that looking backward is really important. You can't only look in the rearview mirror when you're driving a car, but you really need to think about where you've come from and what you've done. I think that if we don't do that, then Obama's going to end up being like Gerald Ford, saying, you know, the long nightmare is over. And then we're going to be saddled with a Reagan type or with another Bush.
I totally agree with you. And also about, you know, we can't live in the past. I'm a perfect example of that. You
totally.
always have to go moving forward. But your present and your future, your past is informed by that.
Yes.
So you really can't go forward in denial that you had a past.
That's right.
And you know what I call his change, but I can't say it on the radio.
So, you say it after we're off.
I'll email it to you again. So I want to ask you this question that I'm personally super interested in. And a lot of people are still interested in Camp Casey and Crawford in 2005. And we were already good friends by the time I went down there.
Yes.
And you sent me an email that just had one line, and it was very interesting. You have called George Bush a dry drunk, and that's somebody who has not gone through any kind of, you know, therapy or gone to AA, just have stopped drinking, and they still have the alcoholic tendencies. They still exhibit, you know, being an alcoholic without actually drinking.
Right.
But you sent me an email, and the one line said, "Congratulations, Cindy, he's drinking again." How did you know that, and what made you think that he was?
I started to think that he was drinking again because he was making even less sense a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I also felt that those accidents he was having, you don't have those unless you're having either some kind of brain damage or you're drinking. I mean, the idea about having that black eye from falling on the floor, choking on a pretzel,
right,
falling off of his, whatever those things are called, those
segways. Yeah.
A variety of things like that. I just feel that his rambling qualities whenever he went off script or off message, there was a quality of repetition that was really what you see with people who they kind of say the same thing over and over again. They repeat their points in a way that is like clinging to a life raft. It's not the same thing as the cadence of a minister who repeats things, you know, for a special effect or does things. This is not with cadence. This is with an anxiety that is trying to, you know, be a white-knuckled sober, white-knuckled drunk. So I thought he was drinking again, and I've just thought that the whole time.
Well, I don't study him as much as you do. I could barely stand to listen to him or watch him, but I did. You know, even though he's just like, he was just a figurehead, he to me is something that represents, for me, justice for my son, justice for over a million Iraqis and the rest of the U.S. soldiers, even though I know that he wasn't in it alone.
He wasn't in it alone, but to say he's just a figurehead is a way of exonerating him from responsibility.
Absolutely. I think
it's a mistake for us to call him a figurehead, because if he is, he chose all the figures around him.
Right.
And he also, I think that one of the things that happens with alcoholics is that they evade blame even from the left, because we say, oh, he didn't really do it, Cheney did it, or he didn't really do it, somebody else did it, he's not smart enough to do it. Well, I know I may be in a minority, but I just don't agree with that. I think that he is responsible, and the buck does stop with him.
Oh, and I totally agree with you, but, you know, sometimes it's dangerous to focus on one person, too, when there's a whole gang of them that need
right. Well, that's true. You don't want to do that,
down.
But,
yeah.
But my worry is that we end up not paying attention to him too often, enough, because we're going to let him, just like I focus on Obama and not all the people around him, although he's hired all these people like Larry Summers and all these other people to work with him who are clearly part of the problem economically.
Well, then a lot of people on the left will say, oh, Obama, you know, he has all these forces surrounding him, and he really wants to do the right thing, but these forces won't let him do the right thing. Then I say, if you believe that about Obama, then you must have also believed that about George Bush. And they don't believe that about George Bush.
Right.
You know, so we have to have some intellectual integrity,
yes,
no matter if we're on the left or on the right or whatever.
Exactly.
But it seemed to me that George Bush totally lost it between Camp Casey, Katrina, and then his presidency just like went into the dumpster for a lot of time. But it seemed like towards the end, he had almost pulled himself together a little bit. Was he just so happy to get the hell out of this? Did he ever realize that he was hopelessly out of his league as president of the United States?
I think he realized he was out of his league very early on.
Just a lot of bluster to try and, okay.
It's a lot of what we call counterphobic behavior. It's like some version of somebody who's constantly saying, I am not afraid, I am not afraid, you know, sort of whistling a happy tune. And I think that that's what he's always done. I think that I wrote some things about his last days and his last speeches that were published in the Daily Beast, and I really felt pretty clearly that he was not better, and that he was he had disorders of thought. I don't have them right here, but they're at dailybeast.com under my name, and I really felt that he was disordered, and he was not making sense at the end. So I don't think he seemed to pull. Sometimes when he puts on a suit and he gets all dressed up and has a lot of time, he looks pretty good.
Right.
And, he's been able to hide drinking from his family and from other people. You know, he could do that for 24 years.
Well,
so he's a pro at that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, definitely. We're almost out of time, but I just want to ask you, did you see the movie W?
Yes, I did.
What did you think of that?
I thought it was a whitewash.
Yeah. Well, I didn't actually see it, but I have seen parts of it. And Josh Brolin, who played George W. Bush, is a friend of mine. But I don't think it was Josh's fault. I think the director...
No, it was Oliver Stone.
Yeah, the director kind of...
Well, he took me to lunch. We talked. He picked my brain about my book and before his movie. And I told him that if he's going to relegate it to alcohol and his father, he's missing the fundamental issue of Bush, which is his cruelty and his pleasure at inflicting suffering on others. And that is so central to his character. And he just would have none of it, Stone.
And you think that that is Bush in a nutshell.
Bush on the couch, Bush in a nutshell, is his sadism.
Well, you know, that, and we talked about his cruelty when he was young, but as a frat boy, he was super cruel to people.
He was cruel as a frat boy. He branded pledges with hot coat hangers on their naked buttocks, and you could hear the flesh sizzle. People would hear the flesh sizzle, and the people would scream. And that's public knowledge. Oh, that's the other thing in my book. It's all I wrote about was public knowledge. This isn't, you know, just because I live in Washington and I sit behind the analytic couch, I actually decided to use only material that's available to the public. He really, people knew this about him, and they dismiss it.
Right. It's amazing to me that somebody like that, such a disordered personality, actually rose to president of the United States. That says a lot about our society, not just about George Bush, but our society. So, Justy, I'm encouraging people to read your book and to not live in the past, but not forget about the past. We cannot allow this to happen again. We always have to hold our leaders accountable, Democrat, Republican, whatever.
Yes.
And thank you so much for joining me at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and hope we can talk again soon.
Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you. You're listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. This is Cindy Sheehan. We'll be right back with a listener soapbox rant after the break.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you're listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.cindysheehansoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.cindysheehansoapbox.com.
Join the tent city next to the National Big Business Gathering at Ford Field on June 15th through 17th, 2009. The National Business Summit, sponsored by the Detroit Economic Club at Ford Field. Millionaire capitalists like the heads of ConocoPhillips, Dow Chemical, General Motors, Chrysler, Humana Incorporated, Ascension Health, BNSF Railway Company, and PVS Chemicals, as well as the presidents of the National Council on Competitiveness and U.S. Chamber of Commerce, will gather at this summit. As well as the presidents of the National Council on Competitiveness and U.S. Chamber of Commerce will gather at this summit. President Barack Obama and cabinet members have been invited. These wealthy businessmen, yes, almost all of them are rich white men, will put their greedy heads together to discuss innovation and policy ideas in technology, energy, environment, and manufacturing. In other words, they will be strategizing on how to further increase their profits at the expense of the ever-shrinking middle class, the vast working class, and the growing millions living in utter poverty. The National Business Summit will be held in a city with record-high unemployment and poverty rates, layoffs, budget cuts, school closings, utility cost hikes and shutoffs, and massive home foreclosures. With a registration fee of $1,495, it is unlikely that any victims of foreclosures and evictions, let alone laid-off workers, will be able to attend the National Business Summit. No one at this event will be speaking in the interests of those most affected by the economic collapse. The People's Summit will be a dynamic event. During the People's Summit, organizers will implement a moratorium on foreclosure evictions by going into the neighborhoods and supporting homeowners who are willing to confront the bailiffs. If there is a strike, demonstration, or sit-in, the People's Summit will join it. The People's Summit will confront the big business CEOs and politicians gathering next door. Join us. That's People's Summit, June 14th through 17th, 2009. Grand Circus Park, Detroit, Michigan. 4 days of active resistance, political discussion, and strategizing for a people's stimulus plan and an economic bill of rights for working people and the poor. At Ford Field on June 15th through 17th, 2009.
Damn, Hillary Clinton is talking about using our military to attack Somalia. To all of you Hillary fans out there, kiss my butt. This bloodthirsty, lawless witch has repeatedly proved to be a lawless, constitution-less, warmongering, war bill signing murderer. The people of Somalia are the victims of nuclear, medical, hazardous waste dumping from foreign ships that sail off of Somalia's coast and dump tons of radioactive material and hazardous waste into Somalia's waters. The recent tsunamis have washed those waste products onto Somalian soil, infecting and killing scores of Somalians. Somalians stand on their shores as mysterious ships appear, anchor down, and dump whatever they want to dump, without fear of any Navy, Air Force, or Coast Guard. Somalians wish they had a Navy, Air Force, and Coast Guard instead of a few brave local kids in a small dinghy. Foreign ships sail to Somalia to steal their fish, tuna, and shrimp. Somalia has no Navy, Air Force, or Marines to protect their nation from foreign thieves and illegal waste dumpers. Do you think the people of Somalia are just going to sit there on their shores and watch scores of ships pass through their waters unmolested? The U.S. government shot and killed 3 teenage Muslims who had the courage to try to serve some justice on their own accord. What did they get? 3 bullets to the head, courtesy of the U.S. government, who believes they have the right to go around this planet and kill whomever they want to. I am sick of this imperialistic government and the suck-up Americans who keep on voting these lawless, bloody traitors into office, i.e., the Democrats and Republicans. Instead of talking about how the Democratic and Republican Party has systematically passed unconstitutional ballot access laws, which make it virtually impossible for anyone to even get on the ballot with Democrats and Republicans. This is why and how no third-party candidate can even get on the ballot, much less come to power. Instead, the media prefers to show the world how big and tough the U.S. government is by killing pirates. Take this fact. Over 300 million worth of tuna, shrimp, and lobster are being stolen every year by illegal trawlers off of Somalia's coast, forcing the fishing industry there into a state of virtual non-existence. Consider what one pirate told the New York Times after he and his men seized a Ukrainian freighter, quote, loaded with tanks, artillery, grenade launchers, and ammunition, end quote, last year. We don't consider ourselves sea bandits, said Saguli Ali. We consider sea bandits those who illegally fish in our seas and dump waste in our seas and carry weapons in our seas. We are simply patrolling our seas. Think of us like a Coast Guard, end quote. Now that Coast Guard analogy is a stretch, but his point is an important and widely admitted part of the story. Indeed, the Times article was titled, Somali Pirates Tell Their Side, They Want Only Money. Yet the New York Times acknowledged, quote, the piracy industry started about 10 to 15 years ago as a response to illegal fishing, end quote. The other side of the piracy coin, is it piracy for a group of citizens of a sovereign, navy-less nation to patrol and protect their fishing areas, enforcing local and natural law violations? But it isn't just the theft of seafood. Nuclear dumping has polluted the environment. In 1991, the government of Somalia collapsed, wrote Johan Harry in The Independent. Its 9 million people have been teetering on starvation ever since. And the ugliest forces in the Western world have seen this as a great opportunity to steal the country's food supply and our nuclear waste in their seas. This is the context in which the pirates have emerged. Somalian fishermen took speedboats to try to dissuade the dumpers and trawlers, or at least levy a tax on them. They call themselves the Volunteer Coast Guard of Somalia, and ordinary Somalis agree. The independent Somalia news site Ward Here News found 70% of Somalians strongly supported the piracy as a form of national defense. I'd like to thank listener Liz Allen for sending me this email. Our Ask Cindy question today comes from Jody Paulson of San Francisco. Writes Jody, I got your campaign email. Love your radio show. Here's a question for Ask Cindy. I'm really frustrated about the fact that third-party candidates like you have been barred from public debate with major party candidates, both in U.S. presidential and congressional races. I think there ought to be an equal time law requiring incumbents for high-level positions like these to debate all willing opponents on the ballot. What can we do to bring about such a law? Jody Paulson of San Francisco. First of all, Jody, I want to disclose also that Jody was an intern on my campaign, so she's not a stranger to me, and she knows what we went through on the campaign. But first of all, Jody, you make a great point about my campaign materials. I can't move on to working on a campaign for 2010 when I still owe so much money for 2008. Listeners, please, please, please go to www.cindysheehanforcongress.org and make a donation to help me clear up my campaign debt. I have a new campaign to pay off my campaign debt called Cindy for Congress Needs a Bailout. I really gave the campaign everything I had and more, and Jody knows this. She's been with me every step of the way, and I'm expecting you to all help me dig out of this hole. As of today, I still owe approximately $19,000. As for your other question about debates, Jody, I searched the web for organizations that support all-inclusive debates, and I couldn't find one. Doesn't mean they're not out there, I just couldn't find one. However, I saw reports of many instances where incumbents, including Dennis Kucinich, congressman from Ohio, where they refused to debate their challengers. And as you know, as Jody knows, and I'm going to tell the listeners, I was in that position myself. My campaign challenged Nancy Pelosi to debates constantly. When I achieved ballot status, after months of gathering signatures, I was legitimately in a position to demand a debate from Nancy Pelosi. Her office ignored our request, or they would say that they were going to talk to the Speaker of the House and get back with us to see if Nancy Pelosi would debate me. And now we all know that she never debated me. I did, however, get on the air with her once when she was on our local NPR station. She got an entire half hour to herself. I was demanding equal time as a challenger, and as a challenger who qualified for ballot status, as a challenger who worked really hard, raised a lot of money. We had to spend every penny plus more, as you just discovered, I'd still have some campaign debt trying to beat Nancy Pelosi. We had to spend tens of thousands of dollars to pay for advertisement on TV, on the radio, in the newspaper that we didn't ever get for free. But the incumbent can get a lot of exposure for free in this media. And so KQED would not put me on. They would not give me equal time. So we had a protest in front of their station down in the Mission, and somebody went in the door, and we followed him in the door, and we demanded equal time, and they did not give me equal time, but they did let me call in and ask Nancy Pelosi a question, and I asked her about impeachment. And after I asked her about impeachment, the host of the show cut me off, and Nancy Pelosi gave her standard blah, blah, blah answer to it. I think the Libertarian, I think the Republican, and I should have been able to go on the same stage, the same platform with Nancy Pelosi, and she should answer to the people of San Francisco for her record. And any qualified candidate should be able to do that with any incumbent. So Jody, thanks for your question. And if you have a question like Jody did, you can email me at cindy@cindysheehansoapbox.com. It can be a question about anything, and if it's appropriate, I'll try and answer it on the air. Okay, your soapbox action today is to turn off your TV as much as possible this week, if you have a TV. I want you to go to the library and get a copy of Justin Frank's book, Bush on the Couch, Or my guest next week is going to be John Perkins. I'm super excited about that. John Perkins has written Confession of an Economic Hitman, and he's written many other books. And he is writing another book right now, but he's going to come out from behind his computer or word processing program and chat with us next week. So this has been Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox this week. I hope you learned something. I hope you email me at cindy@cindysheehansoapbox.com, not just with Ask Cindy questions, but your own soapbox rants, or if you have an event that you want to promote, we'll be happy to do that. We'll be happy to give you a soapbox. So I'd like to thank you for listening. I'd like to thank my guest, Dr. Justin Frank. I'd like to thank my engineer, Scott Cuddy, and my webmaster, Rich Bowser. So we're taking the soapbox on the road, and when I talk to you for the next couple of weeks, we'll be on the road, and I hope to meet as many of you in person as possible. Look on my Blogspot for more information on where I'm going to be and how you can meet me, and I really hope to meet you. So we'll talk to you from the road.
I must make my witness. Have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value. Chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore. Just get up from your chairs right now. Go stick your head out and yell and keep yelling, I'm as mad as hell, I'm not going to take this anymore. Just get up from your chairs.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.